Welcome to episode 166 of the Sentientism Podcast, a podcast about what's real and who matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Kat Woods. Kat is an effective altruist who founded Nonlinear, which incubates artificial intelligence ex-risk nonprofits, that's extinction risks. She co-founded Charity Entrepreneurship, which helps people start new effective charities. And before that, Charity Science Health, which is now known as Savita, an organization that helped to increase immunization uptake in India. She describes her main focus today as trying to make transformative artificial intelligence go well instead of poorly. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 165 others in our treasure trove of a back catalogue. Why not let me know via review or rating? Reviews, ratings, and sharing with friends really helps more people find out about the Sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world towards more compassionate, rational thinking. And that is the plan. You can find out more about Sentientism at our website, sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism, that's sentient with ism on the end, on your favorite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just people who agree with Sentientism. Thanks for listening. Hey, Kat, how are you?
Hey, good. How about yourself?
Very good, very good. Well, it's great to get the chance to talk to you. We've only interacted on Twitter so far. One of the triggers for me reaching out to you was a tweet you posted saying something along the lines of, if you care about ending factory farming, consider working in AI safety. An aligned AGI, artificial general intelligence, would end factory farming. It's quite likely it will happen in the next decade, which I thought was an interesting contentious point of view that we'll come back to later on. It might clash with some of the intuitions of my normal audience, but it fits really well into some of these big questions that I like to ask here, because I guess this series is focusing on what I think of as the most foundational, most important philosophical questions, the questions of what's real and how should we understand the universe, and as importantly, the questions of ethics, what matters, but critically, who gets to matter, who should we feel compassion for, who should we see as a moral patient? And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to develop and popularize sentientism as a really broad, pluralistic, hopefully common sense worldview that suggests when we think about what's real, we should take a naturalistic approach using evidence and reason to try and work out with humility what might be going on around us. And on the ethics question, it's pluralistic on the ethical system we apply, but it's very focused on the moral scope and saying, look, every sentient being, any being that can experience suffering, flourishing, should warrant our compassion, at least in some minimal level. But I'm talking in these conversations to people, whether they agree or disagree with that worldview. So it'll be great to understand your own philosophical journey and how that influences what you do in the world today. I should stop talking, but before we get into those big questions, how would you best introduce yourself and what you do?
Yeah. So, in terms of what I do, I like to think more instead of like, what do I do? It's like, what are the goals? And there's clearly a reason I'm on this podcast is like, so the biggest thing that I care about is preventing suffering risks or S risks. And it's basically like the risk of causing like astronomical amounts of suffering. And like, I think that we're like already in one in a certain sense. I think we're like a super intelligent species compared to say like pigs or chickens, and it's not going great. This is like the worst thing that has ever happened in history as far as I can tell. And I'm like, ugh, like if we're making, like right now we're just racing towards making a species that is much, much more intelligent than us. And that hasn't gone well in the past. And so I really want to make sure that it goes well, not just for us, but also all sentient beings. I think that like, you know, and also future sentient beings as well, right? I think that like how we do play this in the next while could be like the difference between us having like, you know, literally like, the best invention that ever happened. We just kind of like are able to mostly get like, I don't think you can actually get a scenario where everybody gets everything that they want because people have like incompatible desires, but I think you could get like most of it for like most beings. Or we could all die, right? Like everybody, including all the animals, or be stuck in like, you know, basically like a factory farming thing where there's like no escape because like there's no chance of us escaping it, just in the same way there's no chance of a chicken escaping factory farming. And so I'm just basically doing a whole bunch of interventions at more of the meta level, trying to get it so more people are working on this and making sure it goes well, getting the people who are working on it to work on it better, and just generally trying to find leverage points that allow like for this to go like much better. And like I think the other kind of underlying part of the strategy here is also so this idea of passive income that people are really into in like the kind of like 4-hour work week or like early retirement people and stuff like that. And like my stepdad gave me the 4-hour work week when I was 18. I was taking a gap year and it was like the best thing he ever did for me. And what I realized from that is I was like, oh, well, like, so I can have passive income. That's fine. But what if we can cross apply that to impact, like helping people? Like, how do we set up passive impact streams? And then unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, impact is different from income. In that income, there's diminishing returns. So you can just do like 4 hours of working and then you're fine. But it turns out with impact, you can just keep doing more. So I'm just like trying to make as many streams as possible going on in the background. And so that's like the general strategy. So either our organization, like, so I run Nonlinear, and we'll do interventions if like we can make it passive where it's like, okay, it's just gonna be running in the background, doesn't require lots of oversight. And then if it doesn't require, like if it can't be passive for us, then we do is like we help other people start it. So we'll provide things like mentorship or seed funding or introductions and various other sorts of things, just trying to like catalyze things to get things started.
Brilliant, thank you. So in practical terms, I guess what you spent most of your time doing is creating and setting up new NGOs or charities or organizations. Nonlinear is the current one you're focusing on, which is trying to address that agenda. And the way you're thinking about that agenda, which we'll come back to later on, is you're almost seeing there's an analogy between there's non-human animals and then all of a sudden this very powerful human species arrives and it doesn't play out well. And you're taking that analogy to the next level and saying, you know, that could happen to us and all of the other sentient beings if we don't play out the AI agenda correctly. Is that sort of fair?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And like nonlinear, like what we're doing is we're helping other people start things. So it's not necessarily okay. Like, I mean, I did like co-found Nonlinear, but like I'm not like planning anytime soon stepping back. But yeah, it's like an incubator. That's like the closest thing that's like socially legible. I go around, my basic thing is prioritize ideas, make the ideas happen. And one way is like incubating, but there's a whole bunch of different ways to get things to happen in the world. And it doesn't have to be just like a regular incubation project.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, we'll come back to that when we talk about how to make a better world and dig into some of those things. But that's brilliant to cue that up. Let's learn about the philosophical journey you've taken. That's, I guess, your motivation for doing all of that work now. So the first big philosophical question we ask is that one of epistemology, and I sort of summarize it as, you know, what's real, or how do we work out what's real? And for many of my guests, that's been a story about whether they grew up originally in maybe a more religious or supernatural or spiritual environment, or one that was already quite naturalistic, maybe atheistic, maybe agnostic, maybe science-minded, or a mix of the two, and how that side of their thinking has changed over time, if it has. And of course, while in the question of religion and the supernatural looms large, it's not just about that. It's about, you know, epistemology and how to understand the world in general. So yeah, you can go where you like and sort of telling the story and explaining how you think about that stuff now.
Yeah. In terms of religion, I grew up on the west coast of Canada, and it's like a very not religious place, to the point that I remember like when I was like 14 or 13, I remember like till then mostly religion just wasn't talked about. Like there was like, you know, people would go to church on like some people would go to church on Christmas or something, but like that was weird, right? Like most people didn't do that. And you know, it just wasn't a thing. And the only time I heard about like Christianity was in my history class, and also my English class where they were teaching mythology. And it was like, there was like Greek myths, there was like Norse myths, and then there's Christian myths. And I was like, okay, like this is like a thing people used to believe. They don't believe it anymore.
Welcome to the modern world. Yeah.
And then when I actually found out that people really did believe these things, I was like, holy shit. Like I had like kind of the inverse where I was like, oh, I should really look into this because maybe they're right. Maybe I could go to hell. Like that sounds bad, right? So I like kind of like delved into a whole bunch of different things. I briefly like experimented with like Islam and Wiccanism. I never went to Christianity because I was like, that's too boring. That's like regular stuff. My epistemology was not great when I was a teenager, clearly. And then I took a gap year after I graduated when I was 17, and I took a gap year. I was like, aha, I graduated early. That means I get to go travel. And that was like the best decision ever, because so I went to India, and instead of like discovering like spirituality, I read The God Delusion on this like massive train ride. And so, unfortunately, I had my like whole like atheist awakening essentially right when I was in the middle of like the least friendly place for this. Well, not the least, I suppose it could have been like I could have been in Saudi Arabia or something. But yeah. It's like I'm just surrounded by all these hippies and stuff, and I'm like,
you had the wrong religion. Sort of awakening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then for me, like religion just hasn't been like a big thing in my life, like just because then I've been part of the effective altruism community, the EA community, and like, you know, there's like minority groups in like conferences, and there's like, you know, it's like women, and then there's like religious people, like the minority group, right? So it's just hasn't been very big.
When you read The God Delusion and you sort of dug into different religions, what path did you take there? Because some people will they'll see some of the harms of institutional religion and won't see that the facts add up, but they'll still want to hold on to something that's to do with transcendence or spirituality and find maybe a spiritual but not religious route. Other people will go down the sort of angry atheist route where they'll see religion as a source of terrible evils that needs to be crushed from the world because one, it's wrong, and two, it justifies terrible harms. Others will acknowledge some of that story but want to balance that out with seeing the benefits of community and compassion and, you know, the good aspects that come through. How did that leave you thinking about, you know, religion writ large?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think at the beginning, I just thought it was like clearly bad, but like it was mostly just a fact of like the fact that I hadn't actually interacted with anybody who was really religious.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, like it's really easy to demonize somebody that you haven't met. And for me, it mostly just came out and I just became super sciencey. Like it just got me into, because like there was nothing really to fight against. Like, it was just kind of like, oh, there's these stupid people who are believing stupid things, like, but they're not in my life, in my world at all. And so, like, there's not much to do there. But I was mostly just like, oh, my God, like, I need to read everything about evolution and, like, you know, like, science and, like, psychology and everything, right? And so it mostly just played out as, like, a positive thing as opposed to, like, being anti-something in particular.
Makes sense. And then when you got to meet religious people, you realize they're not stupid and they're good people. And, you know, they're just as varied as anybody else, I guess, but yeah, exactly.
And
it's almost a mirror image of what, you know, the way some religious communities might see atheists. You know, there's this sort of stereotype that we're eating babies and clearly have no moral grounding. And
yeah,
but, well, okay, when you get to know us, you'll realize, you know, we're not all that bad.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually an interesting experience I had. I was living in this village in Rwanda for a bit. I was doing research, trying to figure out like basically next steps about how best to help the world. And I was staying at this family, and like Rwanda is an extremely religious country, like very, very religious. And at first I didn't mention, they would always ask like, you know, like what sort of Christianity you are or something, right? And I would just kind of give some vague answer. I'm like, like, you know, cause like at first I was like worried that like they would be like mad at me or something somehow, but I ended up started just telling everybody like, oh, hey, yeah, I'm an atheist. Right. And it was actually great because I was going there, like I'm like a humanitarian aid worker, basically going there trying to like help people. And I'm like, that's like nice friendly demeanor. And I'm trying to like help them and they're really liking that. And then they're like, but you're an atheist. And that was actually really helping. Like, I feel like for them. Yeah, like I think this is like I might have been the first atheist anybody had ever met. And I was like, actually, this is good. Like, I should be letting people know, because it's like, oh, hey, I'm clearly not eating babies. Like, I'm trying to like save them. That's my goal.
Yeah, thank you. No, that's fascinating. Yeah. So you were just about to come on to this sort of broader epistemology question, because one, you know, in a way, there's quite a simple choice, right? You can either do, you know, a sort of fideistic approach based on faith, or a sort of dogmatic approach where you've arbitrarily picked something, or a sort of relativistic approach, or even a solipsistic approach where you sort of deny that there is an objective reality. So there's a bunch of different approaches you can go, or you can follow a broadly construed naturalistic route. That doesn't mean you have all the answers. But so how do you think about epistemology generally now? Yeah.
you know, funnily enough, so like I feel like basically all of between the years of like 2013 and like 2020, I was like very hardcore. I'm like, oh, we'll just do RCTs for everything. Like if it doesn't have.
So there's randomized control trials. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If it doesn't have any of those, like then like I won't believe it. And like I did, like I had like, you know, spreadsheet models calculating everything and just all that stuff. And then I just like, so I had this when I was younger, I was like, okay, well, like one of the first things you should figure out is like how to get yourself to do things. Like if you can't do things, then nothing else follows, right? And so I was trying to study like, you know, getting yourself to do stuff. And so I set the goal of I was going to read a paper, like a psychology paper on willpower every day. And then I would summarize it to my boyfriend at the time. And this is my first actual experience with real science, as opposed to before I'd just been reading popular science books. And what I realized when I was like reading these papers, I was like, oh, this is crap. Like, they ran like 100 tests and like only 3 of them came back with any sort of effect. And the effect size was small. And they're like putting that up in the abstract as if this is like the best thing ever. And this is actually just nothing, like nothing happened.
And these were the ones that got published, the results that got published.
Yeah. Right. Right. And so it was like, and at the time I just kind of updated it. I'm like, oh, willpower research is dumb. Right. But I'm sure the rest of science is totally fine. And then basically I just spent more and more time actually interacting with science and realizing like, ah, you know, I think it's a Churchill quote, like democracy is the worst political system, except it's like the least bad of all the political systems available.
Yeah.
I think science is like terrible, but it's like, it's certainly better than your gut most of the time. Right. Yeah. So like, you know, like the only reason we can see that is because we actually have ways to evaluate science, as opposed to like, you know, well, actually we have studied the gut and it's like quite terrible. Like we're bad at most things. Like it's always news when it is good at something. Right. So anyways, I just got more and more like my confidence intervals around what was true just got wider and wider throughout this time. And I would like go and try something. Then I'd do an RCT on it and I'd find out that it didn't work. Or like, you know, I'd find this like crucial consideration that totally like changed the sign of what I was doing and like made it like instead of net positive, was net negative. And I just got more and more uncertain. And I like in 2020, I basically got into like this like complete epistemic angst. I was like, I can't know anything. Right. Like, you know, just like nobody knows anything. I don't know anything. And I actually briefly gave up for a bit. I was like, well, like, you know, if I can't know anything, I'm just going to go be like a hippie in the woods. I don't know. Make some art, do some drugs. I don't know. Have a good time. But then I just kept caring about stuff that was happening in the world. I was like, ah, like somebody should do something about that. I'm like, remember, you can't know. And then I was like, I'm going to care. So eventually I just realized I'm like, I just have to keep going. Like, I can't give up.
In a way, there's at least two motivations for wanting to understand the world. One is just because intrinsically you think it's good to understand the world well. And the other one is because you care about shit. And if you care about stuff, you need to understand stuff to do it. So it's sort of, it's interesting. But the path you followed, I think, is interesting because some people will go down that path and just become disillusioned with the whole thing as you did temporarily and sort of give up on the idea and become super cynical and super skeptical. Other people never find that path and maintain this sort of super hopeful optimism that we really can clarify and lock everything down and lead them into maybe a naive view of science. But my guess is you probably found some sort of middle way where, like you say, it's the worst, the least bad system. But so let's approach it with humility at least, and let's still keep working.
Yeah. So where is my epistemic style? It's really hard to divide it from my ethics because, like, I do think like a lot of people, they care about truth intrinsically. And for me, it's definitely instrumental. Like, it's because like there is suffering in the world. I want the suffering to be gone. To get there, I need to have truth. And so like, if I was very confident that we just like eliminate all the suffering, everybody's living their best lives, like I would totally go live in like La La Land. I don't really care about truth specifically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And that's actually part of why, like, so one of the things that people struggle with AI and like it taking over, they're like, oh, well, why would it have these like other goals, right? And it's like, oh, well, like this is like instrumental convergence. It's like this thing of like, oh, hey, like truth is useful for pretty much any goal you have, right? And I feel like the same way with like money or influence, right? Like I'm like, I don't really need that much money. I like need nothing. Like I'm so like, I can live off of like practically nothing I have for most of my life, being totally happy. But like, I'm like, but I can use money to like help people. Right. And so then I'm like, okay, I need to get more. Right. And so I can totally see how an AI would go in that direction and like be truth seeking, be money seeking, be influence seeking. Cause like, I feel like that's like what already happened with me. And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm not that smart compared to a super intelligence. So it's totally going to figure that out too.
Yeah. To achieve whatever the goal might be, right. Whatever the goal is, you need knowledge and resources and influence and power. Yeah. That's a really clear answer on the sort of what's real question. It's like a reluctant, you know, okay, naturalism and science is pretty much all we've got. It's desperately flawed. It's a human endeavor. The world is complicated, but it's the best we've got. So let's just keep trying to do that. And hope. And I think that's a really healthy attitude because in a way, I think that's one of the criticisms that's thrown against people who have a naturalistic or a scientific worldview. And it's sometimes framed as a sort of it's a term I don't really like, but as a scientism, where there's such a blind confidence that, you know, science, we've done the RCTs, we have the answer, you know, it almost can become a dogma in its own right. And you can see some scientists and some science communicators fall foul of that. Whereas to my mind, that humility and that doubt is actually the heart of a proper naturalistic and scientific worldview. And you know, science institutionally, if not individually, is about error correction. And, you know, I spoke to Katie Mack, who's a brilliant cosmologist and an astrophysicist. And I said to her, well, you know, I think people are being unfair when they criticize science in this way, because as I understand it, you love finding errors in your own work. And she said, not so much in our own work, but we do love finding errors in other people. We do love finding errors in other people's work. So that's why, you know, that's why the institution works. But scientists are still human after all. Yeah. So that's been brilliant. Thank you. Let's come on to the ethics question. So with people who have either left a religious worldview or never really had one, there's an obvious answer question, which is, okay, so what are your ethics grounded in? You know, if you don't have an old man with a beard on a cloud with a thunderbolt threatening you, what do good and bad and right and wrong even mean? Like, you don't have a list of rules in a book. You don't have some ultimate punishment. You know, surely all atheists are just nihilists running around, you know, pillaging and, you know, with no moral foundation at all. So I'm not going to ask that silly question, but I'd be interested in your journey for thinking about ethics, because in a way you've already answered the question, a concern with suffering and reducing suffering. But what was the journey to how you came to think about right and wrong and good and bad, what they mean, and how do you frame those things now?
Yeah. So I feel like I basically developed a conscience when I was 12. I think before that, I was just like, I don't know. Like, I definitely feel like my prefrontal cortex came online when I was 12. Like, I feel like there's this distinctive period of time when, like, before I was like some larva. And then, like, all of a sudden, I was able to, like, plan. I was able to empathize. I was able to, like, you know, like, reason and stuff. And at the age of 12, I discovered, like, on my mom's bookshelf, there was a book about farms. And I was 12. I thought this was going to be, like, Old MacDonald Had a Farm kind of book. But it was a book about factory farming. And by the end of the first chapter, I was a vegetarian. And by the end of the book, I was a very annoying vegetarian. So I was a 12-year-old girl who was very upset about factory farming. And like, I just, you know, went around, and like, it was very foundational to like all of my ethics too, in the sense that like, I remember I went to class and I thought like, oh, people just don't know, right? When I tell them, they will update and then they'll stop doing it, right? Like, duh, right? And unsurprisingly, this did not happen.
What sort of response did you get at school and from family and friends from this clear, obvious moral truth you were helpfully explaining to them?
Yeah. Fortunately, I was lucky to have my mom. So she's not a vegetarian, but she's like a guilty non-vegetarian. Like, she's read the books. She becomes vegetarian off and on. She cycles through it. But she just has trouble keeping the diet, essentially. So she was super supportive of me doing it, at least, right? So that was like nice and really good. And then, yeah, my friends were just like, you know, like whatever. I don't even remember their actual reactions. I do remember they were very annoyed by every time they ate meat for like the first like month. I would like cry for 5 minutes, and like they weren't exactly a fan of that. But I think they thought I was just like overreacting or something. And I think this is actually good for me, because like I think like I started off my ethical journey living in a world where pretty much everybody is doing something I consider deeply unethical, and I'm still able to get along with everyone, right? Like, I'm not like, oh, hey, like, let's burn everything down. I can't be friends with anybody who doesn't have my same ethical views. Obviously, I still go around. I'm always trying to convince people to switch and everything. But the thing is like, usually the best way to do that is not by like being really mad and like, you know, like threatening to isolate them unless they don't do the thing. And so I kind of wish other people had gone through this, because I feel like a lot of times when people are like getting into college and they're like, you know, oh, hey, I discovered this ethical wrong that's happening. Like, and then they're like, oh, hey, I should just go and make like everybody miserable until this is fixed. And it's like, this is not actually the best strategy. Like, even if like it should be fixed, right? Like, you have to have like a better strategy for being able to convince people. So anyways, fast forward, I read a book when I was 14 about environmentalism. I was like, oh my God, I gave up everything. I gave up the paper towel. I didn't fly anywhere. And then some people said, hey, if you care about these things, you're going to care about global poverty. And I was like, la, 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 don't tell me. I don't want to know, because I've already given up bacon. I've already given up paper towel. what more do you want from me, right? Like, I'm sure if I look into this, I'm going to care. And if I care, I'm going to have to do something, right? And so I kept my head in the sand for a few years. And then when I was 18, I somehow accidentally watched a documentary about global poverty. And I cared and had to do something. And it was then that I realized, and this is like, I feel like this is like the foundation for my ethics, is like, I basically realized that by me keeping my head in the sand for those years, I could have been helping during all that time. And so basically I was contributing to the problem by staying ignorant and not trying to do something about it. And so like, this is I basically independently discovered like the drowning child argument that Peter Singer is famous for, which is like, if you're walking by a pond, you see a drowning child, what do you do? Like, obviously you go in and save the child, but like, what if it ruins your $200 pair of shoes, right? And people are like, what? That does not matter, right? What matters is the child's drowning. And he says, like, what if the child's drowning on the other side of the world? Like, does that change anything? Does distance change anything? And like, he basically gets to this thing of like, you know, you're obligated to help up until like, you have to give up something of moral equivalent that you would be helping for and everything. And so that's just been like the driving force of my life since that realization of just, and I spent like a year trying to understand everything wrong with the world. Again, I was very annoying. I'm surprised I have any friends from that period of time. And yeah, and then like, I was just trying to prioritize and stuff. And then I discovered like effective altruism, which is basically a lot of this already, right? Yeah, and then in terms of like the actual ethics, I used to be like, so like utilitarianism is correct. And everybody else is wrong or confused. And
yeah, it feels like quite a common vibe in the EA community. I'm not sure it's quite as prevalent as the stereotype, but.
Well, it was certainly true with me. And then basically I just, you know, the more you study a thing, the more nuance you get, the more you realize it's like, what? Like, and I think for me right now, it's come down to this foundational thing of like, I think that ethics is like, it's just like a goal you have in your brain. There's like, you know, a set of goals that you have. And people have different goals, right? So like humans tend to overlap a lot because we're like pretty similar, but we also have differences, right? So I think that like, you know, I think some people intrinsically value freedom and I think other people don't, right? And a ton of confusion comes from that because people are saying like, no, you only care about freedom because it brings you happiness, right? And you're just confused, right? And they're like, no, I actually really, I care about freedom even if it makes me less happy. And like, and I think that since it's all coming from your brain and there are different goals, like and people have different goals, then like you should not expect it to be simple and elegant because like brains are messy. They're like a product of evolution. So you should actually expect your ethics to not boil down to like two numbers, like probability times value, right? That is not, that's probably not going to be it. And so now I'm like this weird, like, you know, mix of a million different things. And like, I'm like, okay, like, you know, I'm like broadly still like you can, if you model me as a utilitarian, you're still going to get most of the way there, but like, I will like, you know, I have like a whole bunch of stuff that I will and won't do that like will come up and everything. So
yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at now.
I find it fascinating because sentientism is ethically pluralistic. So it doesn't have a stance on which ethical system. And that's quite deliberate. Personally, in a sense, I probably am a consequentialist because for me, all value tracks back to the quality of experience and the interests of sentient beings. And those are consequences in a sense. So in that very broad sense, I'm consequentialist. And I sometimes joke with virtue ethicists and deontologists that, you know, if their virtues and rules are deliver consistently positive outcomes, then, you know, I'm on board, but otherwise not so much, right? So in a sense, even those ethical systems ultimately often are somewhat consequentialist because virtue ethics is concerned with, you know, doing good. It's not just about being good. Anyway, so it's quite pluralistic. And I agree about that massive complexity because sentient beings, human and not, have a dazzling variety of things that matter to us in lots of different ways. And the way I've sort of tried to suggest the sentientist stance is one that it says you can use whatever ethical system you like in a sense, as long as every sentient being warrants compassion. And I guess that's the common sense way I try and address that complexity, because if you have compassion for another sentient being, you try and care about what matters to them rather than artificially imposing some metric on them from the outside that you then use to calculate what's good and bad. But one of my most recent episodes was with Peter Singer. And we had a fascinating and quite, I think, somewhat challenging conversation because, in a sense, I was saying to him that utilitarianism has been an enormous force for good at pushing our moral scope more broadly, because, you know, go back to Bentham and everybody else, at least in theory, says utility, suffering, flourishing, pain, pleasure matters regardless of species, and coming to our later conversation, even regardless of substrate, right? They all matter. So it's been great in that sense. But there are criticisms of utilitarianism that flow into criticisms of EA as well, which are that, okay, it's great you've really pushed the scope hard and broad in a very demanding way. It can be challenging, but in a way you've got to face up to it. But there is a sense that it feels like it can then have disconnected from the individual sentient beings we're concerned with, so that you can get this sense that utility is some sort of abstract value to be maximized, and that, you know, we might care about the interests for being and not suffering, but we're not that bothered about its interest in continuing to live, because if we could kill it humanely, you know, the being doesn't exist anymore, so there's no harm done. And some of those ways of thinking, you can get into the logic of the larder and some other modes of thinking that are deeply distressing if you apply them to humans, right? I think what they've done is they've lost that common sense view of, you know, I care about what matters to you, you know, and I have compassion for you and what matters to you. I'm not making some independent judgment of your happiness, your pleasure, your suffering, and then making decisions on that perspective. I'm actually taking your perspective seriously. And that doesn't mean it's easy. My sense is we have to retain that connection with the other, and our choice to care about others is, for me, the essence of, you know, all morality, as long as it's not nihilistic.
Interesting. Yeah, a couple of things that come from that. Well, one is, for at least like the death thing, if you're a preference utilitarian, so you care about like people's preferences being met, then like you still care about death.
Yeah, because there's an interest in, yeah. But I also find it interesting, even from a purely hedonic stance, because do hedonic utilitarians acknowledge the opportunity cost of the utility you're bringing to an end? So, you know, if there is, for example, a farmed animal living a net positive, happy life, and you kill it because you want to sell bits of its body or eat it, there's an opportunity cost, even in purely hedonic utilitarian terms, aren't there, of ending that net positive life, even if you ignore rights and the preference to live and the betrayal and the, you know, all the other reasons what we might want to do.
You're saying like they could have lived like longer and happier, right?
Yeah.
If you hadn't killed them, or
okay. Yeah. So it feels like there's an opportunity cost there anyway. I mean, if you want to maximize utility, why would you end the existence of a being that is experiencing positive utility moment to moment? I don't quite get it.
Yeah, well, I think like at least like this is not my moral view.
Yeah,
I'm trying to channel what like I think like a pure hedonic utilitarian would think, and they would think like, oh well, if you like then like replace it with another cow or something, then it's like fine. Like they're basically like, you know, replaceable is like fungible utility. Yeah.
That's the idea, right? That utility is this sort of abstract quantity floating in some sort of godlike spreadsheet that we have to maximize. And I'm like, yeah, I can see why that might be a useful framework for certain types of policy decision, but ultimately compassion for other sentient beings and those individual sentient beings feels more centrally salient to me. And that's partly why I frame sentientism as deliberately ethically pluralistic rather than sort of plumping for one, you know, ethical system. But
yeah, no, that totally makes sense. That totally makes sense. Like, and also the epistemics, like a lot of my world model is really like we need to build and align AI, and then it will figure out most of everything else, right? So we just need to get in like good values. I actually think that it doesn't even have to be my values. So like I'm a person who thinks that everybody has different values, right? So they're like aligned with humans, right? It's just like which human, right? And I think there's like a lot of like, you know, potential peaks that like, you know, sentient beings could get to. And like, I don't know, if it was like Eliezer's, it would probably be fine. I sometimes worry because he like doesn't think that most animals are sentient, but I think that's an epistemic thing. If the AI was aligned with his values care about sentient beings, right? He just doesn't think they're sentient. And so like the AI would just update and be like, dude, look, like, come on. These are definitely sentient. What are you talking about?
Which I think is an interesting example of why, you know, ethics isn't enough, right? So some people, when we're talking about the sentientism idea, will say, well, why do you need this commitment to evidence and reason? Isn't compassion for all sentient beings enough? And it's like, well, no, right? I think all of the human caused problems we see either come down to a failure of ethics or compassion. You know, we just exclude arbitrarily some human or non-human sentient beings from our consideration, and that's an ethical failure because we've excluded valid moral patience. But it's just as common that we might be compassionate people, but we just make some terrible mistake about reality. And to my mind, that is one, right? you know, follow a sort of Descartesian model of just denying the sentience of others.
It's an interesting question of like how much, like, I feel like there's definitely been like moral progress in the last like 300 years in terms of like, you know, like lots of better things are happening for more people and everything. But it's an interesting question, how much of that is ethical progress versus epistemic progress, right? So like, and I don't actually have a strong view on which is which, but I do think, for example, like, oh, hey, we just got like more studies in. Turns out like Black people are basically white people. They are the same people. Like, we're not that different, right? And like, you know, if you had bad science back in the day, maybe you would think that. I do think that probably with the slavery, that was not, so slavery, it's mostly like slavery, women. There's obviously like caring about like, you know, like everybody, right? Like, we always talk about like, I feel like Black people and women are kind of like main part of our like historical narrative of like progress in morals. But like, we also forget, like, you know, like, you go back to the year 1600, they didn't, if you were a white male in like England in 1600, you were also treated terribly, not as bad as women and slaves, but still incredibly poorly. You were allowed to be tortured if, like, you know, your master like did like a mistake, like forced to like sleep in, like, anyways, there's just like all sorts of terrible things, right? So like, we've had moral progress for pretty much everybody except for animals. Yeah, that's really unfortunate. And even for animals, like, I think, you know, if you go back 200 years, you wouldn't have to put like, you wouldn't have to make it illegal for people to go into factory farms and like take pictures. It'd be like, whatever, take as many pictures as you want. It's awesome. So the fact that we're like not able to look at it is like a sign of moral progress. But obviously, I'd rather just get rid of it. That would be better. But you know,
So in terms of your ethics, there's a strong focus on suffering and seeing suffering as a bad thing, which I think is just in the definition of what suffering is, right? Suffering is a negative valenced experience for the individual, so it's bad. And I'm personally quite comfortable making that link between, you know, the good bad of experience and the good bad of ethics. I think, you know, that's a pretty solid connection to make. But do you also see the other side of that as well? How do you think about suffering versus flourishing and positive experiences? Or do you weight those in different ways? Because one obvious way to, you know, end all suffering is to end the existence of all sentient life.
Yeah. So I have like this crazy belief that I think suffering is bad. And I think like killing the entire world is bad. I don't know. These are like, these both seem like pretty foundational. Like, I know. Like, I feel like, you know, because there is like, you know, there are people who are like super far in like the negative utilitarian side of things, where like they like only care about like suffering. They don't really care about adding happiness. And like, I have talked to some people who were like, yeah, like if I could press the button, that would just end all sentient life, right? And I think that if your conclusion after thinking about ethics is to murder everybody, like, you need to go back and check your calculations. Like, something went wrong there. Like, this is like, this should be like almost like an axiom of like ethics or something. It's like, okay, like, you know, like, there are things that are questionable, right? But like, this is like one of the things where you're like, okay, you're acting like a villain in a superhero movie, right? Like, like, question what's going on there.
And it does link to the, you know, the logic of the larder thing we were talking about before, right? Because I do think there is something about, you know, I think the only way to compassionately kill someone, and I mean that in terms of any sentient being, is when it's in their best interest as an individual, i.e., you know, if they're suffering from terminal horrific suffering such that they would not want to continue existing, then it's compassionate to kill them. But otherwise, I don't see how you can think of it as being compassionate to end the life of a being that wants to keep living. And I think that's true in terms of the Thanos snap, and I think it's true in the concept of, you know, even painlessly killing a farmed animal, right? It's just, and I sort of agree, there's something there about the interest in continuing to live. If we're going to be compassionate, we're going to commit to compassion, surely that's something we should.
A couple things. One is, so I think that, like, you know, that's generally true, right? But I also think it's like compassionate to say like you're like in Nazi Germany or something, and like somebody's running like a concentration camp, and like you kill the person who's running their job, right? All of these Jewish people will somehow escape. Let's just imagine this thought experiment, they can escape somehow. Like, there's a way out, right? I think then the compassionate thing to do is to kill the Nazi.
Oh, right? Completely. Yeah.
But for me, I'm kind of in this like rock and hard place. I'm like, the suffering's really bad. I think like, no, factory farming is like, just, I don't know how you can look at that and not think this is the worst thing ever, right? And then you have on the other side, which is that like, well, everybody dying would be bad. Like, I feel like that's just like foundational. And so my way through this is to, let's make an AI that will fix it, right? Because like, basically, like, and I also think you can't get out of it by killing everybody, because then evolution, like, life will evolve somewhere else. and suffering will continue, right? So you'd have to have like a supercharger that goes and make sure everything stays dead. And like, I don't know, I mean, maybe you could do that, but that seems like a bit much.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? Because I find a lot of these thought experiments and hypotheticals fascinating. And I think they're really useful because they do help to pressure test the way we think. But at the same time, we need to be a little bit careful not to take them too seriously and sort of draw back to the practical choice we have here. But I think, so you'll find amongst people who say, you know, I agree with sentientism, Jen, you'll find a lot of different views. But personally, I think I end up in a similar place to you, which is like ending everything, I don't like that approach. Suffering is absolutely catastrophically awful. Can't we find some better path that involves both existence and not catastrophic suffering? Is there some way there? Right? But before we come on to, you know, how you suggest we make that happen via an aligned AGI, just to crispen up on how you think about moral patience, it's pretty clear. I mean, your first sort of ethical thinking was about non-human animals, and then you almost sort of went back to think about human animals too. Do you think of sentience as a useful way of setting that boundary, or do you have something else that, you know, defines who we should feel compassion for in our ethics?
No, I think it's not quite sentientism. I mean, you can only fit so much in a word, so like I'm going to take it.
Yeah, and it's only a baseline sort of foundation, right? It's not a complete ethical system, right? There's loads more you have to do on top of it, but it's just suggesting that foundation that we should have compassion for all sentient beings, and then you can go beyond or do more.
Yeah, so I think it's like the valence of sentience, right? So it's like, hey, is it like positive or negative? So you could imagine some sort of sentient being that has no preferences and no like emotions, but it's just like aware of the color green or something, and like, you know, I don't really care about that, right? So you can imagine there is this power. I don't know how common that is. The AI will figure it out. So I care about like suffering and like happiness, or like basically valence, right? That's like the main thing. And then also preferences. I think like I do also care about the preferences of the individuals, regardless of whether it makes them happy or unhappy. And so that's kind of like a separate thing.
Would you care about the preferences of a non-sentient being?
I don't think you can. I think I'm thinking of preferences as being like a experience of preference. Right? I don't think like you could a calculator. Oh, actually, I don't know if calculator. Probably not. You know, it's very hard to tell. We don't have tools to measure sentience.
We don't. Well, that's helpful. Thank you very much. Right. So let's come on to the final big question, which is how can we make a better world? And you've got this idea about how we might be able to make this happen, which I think will sound very dissonant to many of my listeners. Some maybe not so much, but some it will. Because if you think about people who are engaged in the non-human animal ethics space, whether they're vegans and advocates and they're trying to end factory farming, but also other forms of farming and animal exploitation, I think that the general logic will go, look, there's 8 billion sentient human animals on the planet, many of whom are suffering terribly. There's 80 to 100 billion sentient non-human land animals in farms who are suffering terribly. And there's absolutely no need to do that because plants are edible, right? So not only is this a massive problem, it's also a trivially easy one to fix, subject to a just transition and a bit of, you know, working it through. But technically, it's relatively easy, right? So there's that. Then there's 1 to 2 trillion aquatic animals, and maybe even more than that. It's almost possible to quantify how many there are that are either wild caught or farmed in aquatic situations, which again, ultimately with the transition, we could just end. So why the hell aren't we working towards that? And then with many of them, although this is one interesting tension between, I guess, the central gravity of the vegan movement and sentientism, there's potentially a quadrillion sentient beings living free-ranging or liminally around us or free-ranging in the wild, that there is also widespread suffering as well. So in that context, right, where we have countless quintillions of very obviously suffering biological sentient beings, why should sort of animal people care about AI and AI safety, either because, you know, those AIs could conceivably become sentient, so there's another class of moral patients we should worry about, or because of the impact that AI and maybe even AGI could have on all of those sentient beings. So how do you respond to that? Because many people will say, look, this is really sort of might be intellectually interesting, Jamie, but it's basically a sort of sci-fi crazy topic. We've got enough to deal with here. Look, I know you like the ethical consistency of saying sentientism is substrate neutral as well as species neutral, but let's get back to the, you know, the real urgent problem here of the sentient beings that actually exist today. anyway, how do you respond to that sort of default stance?
Well, I mean, for me, like, and the reason I posted that tweet is because I just keep coming back to, like, you know, like I do think that working on AI safety, like, it could be the, like, best way to help with factory farming and literally all other problems. And that's, like, my biggest motivation, right? So, like, I just feel like I'm, like, I've worked a lot in animal rights in the past 10 years, and it's still, like, definitely the closest cause there to my heart, because it's, like, just the worst, right? Like, just what the fuck are we doing? This is just, anyways.
And that's fascinating, because most of the people involved in AI safety, their motivation is about X risk and S risk and the bad things that could happen from it. But yours is, there could actually be a good outcome here.
Yeah, yeah. And to be fair, also, a lot of people who are in AI safety, like, it's a huge percentage who are vegan and vegetarian. And, like, it's really quite common, especially if they were EAs who got into AI safety, because, like, there's the most obvious actionable thing you can do to, like, reduce suffering in the world.
That's fascinating as a tangent, because that may well be true in the AI safety space, but it's certainly not true in the AI space generally. And I've had conversations with like Josh Gellers and Roman Yampolsky and loads of other people who are, you know, really deeply invested in even ideas like robot rights and granting moral consideration on a relational basis to AIs, and even if they're not sentient, right? So in a way, that's sort of super generously compassionate, but many of those fields and people really struggle to engage with the obvious implications of sentient animal agriculture as well. But it's encouraging that in the AI safety space it feels different.
And so in terms of, okay, so, like, addressing, like, the sci-fi concern, I was actually super skeptical of AI for, like, because, like, my community, like, I was the person who went around and I would, like, go and try and convince people at EA conferences to not work in AI safety. Like, I and now I'm going around the opposite, because, like, whatever I believe, obviously I go and try and convince people. This is what I do. And the thing that changed my mind was realizing that it could be a lot sooner. Right. So basically, we have this unknown time frame of, like, AIs, like, computers are getting smarter and smarter, right? Like, if you zoom in at pretty much any level, like, you go back to, like, 100 years or so when, like, it was invented or something, it's just, like, incredibly, like, going straight up, smarter and smarter in tons of different areas, right? But I kind of thought that we were ages away from creating something that could be super powerful, right? I was like, like, this is like trying to figure out internet security in the 20s, right? Like, this is not going to work, right? And then I realized, I'm like, well, okay. How probable does it have to be that it happens in, say, the next 5 or 10 years for me to think that this is the most important thing to, like, work on, right? And I realized the probability doesn't have to be that high, because it's everybody. It's like, oh, hey, if you care about any cause area, like, this will fuck it up or make it fixed, right? Like, it's everything. So, like, I don't know, you probably wear a helmet, or, like, you probably, like, wear a seatbelt when you ride, like, drive in the car, right? The probability of this helping you is, like, in the orders of, like, 1 in 100,000 kind of level, right? Like, it's probably never gonna actually help you, but you still do it anyways, right? And that's for, like, roughly a 1 in 100,000 chance it'll help you. And then, like, imagine, like, that, but times, like, you know, like, quintillions of people, right? And all of a sudden you're getting into this, like, view of, like, oh, hey, like, I should do more. And the thing is that it's not like you have to get into, like, 1 in 100,000 chance it happens in the next 10 years, right? Like, things are moving fast. Right, the people who invent, basically the founding fathers, essentially, of AI in, like, the last 10 years have come out publicly saying that they're worried about this. They're like, oh man, like, AI is moving fast. It could be soon. Like, we need to take this seriously and, like, be safe, right? And I mean, if you look, have you played around with ChatGPT? ChatGPT is smarter than half of humans on almost any metric of intelligence. Like, really sit with that for a moment. It is smarter than half of all of humanity. And on almost any metric, if there's, like, 30 metrics of intelligence, it's, like, better on, like, 25 of them than half of people. So, like, it was given an IQ test where it just failed every single visual question because it can't see. And it still scored 50th percentile. Like, and 2 years ago, that was not the case. It would have scored, like, I don't know, like, 20 or something on the IQ test, right? It was, like, very dumb.
So that's part of the point you're making. The point you're making isn't about what's the capability today, it's look at the curve, right? And they're not going to get worse. So even if you think it's going to be slower and take longer, or okay, but it's still going in a particular direction. I find, again, I'm a total amateur in this space, but some of the pushbacks I hear, I'm not sure there's that much substance, right? Because you can say, well, it sounds sci-fi, but so what, right? What, let's talk about how this thing might work. But then people will make more specific suggestions. And, you know, some of the most naive ones are like, we can just turn it off. And it's like, we have a Roomba that will basically fight to get back to its power source, right? So it doesn't take much to extrapolate that. They might say, well, okay, it doesn't have goals or an intent. It's like, well, why not, right? The GPT today has at least a minimal goal of responding to your prompt. And you can quite easily give it agency by asking it over and over again, you know, how are you doing now? What do you want to do next, right? And it will even write a Python program for you, a script that will ask itself that. So adding agency to these things is trivially easy too. And then the people will often also say, okay, but it can't do X, Y, or Z things in terms of active, you know, work in the world. And we're chipping away at those by giving it API access to basically everything already. But I said to someone recently, I said, well, think about, you know, if you had one, the ability to gather resources and money, and you have an internet browser and you can engage with other people using text, what's the limit to the bad you could do there, right? You can hire a hitman, you don't have to get into even particularly advanced capabilities before you can work out how, without too many steps, even from what we have today, even without an AGI or something that is radically different, you can sort of feasibly see where the harm might come from. And we're not even talking about a sort of sci-fi scenario either. So I'm somewhat sympathetic to sort of going through that journey and going, I understand the intuitive pushback, but, you know, we don't need a sci-fi scenario to see some real risks. And as you say, many of the leaders of the field are somewhat grudgingly acknowledging that today. But
yeah, and even the people who are building it, I feel like people are saying, oh, hey, don't worry about AI safety, it's fine, right? And the building the guys, like the head of DeepMind and OpenAI, who are the biggest leaders in the field, have all publicly said multiple times that they think that what they're building might kill everybody, right? Like, it's not like they're saying like, oh no, there's some weird people who worry about that. They're like, no, we worry about this too. So like, it's kind of like being like, oh, like imagine a company said like, hey, we're worried that this like product we're building might be dangerous. And then everybody says, nah, don't worry about it. You don't know what you're talking about. You're like, wait, what? No. If they're worried about it, if they're not worried about it, that doesn't mean you shouldn't not worry because they have incentives to make it seem fine. But if they're going and trying to tell you, like, please regulate us because we're worried we might kill everybody, like, listen to them. Like,
yeah. And it comes back to what you said earlier on, which is you don't need to think this is 100% going to happen. You just need a probabilistic view of a possible outcome that could have a very, very serious impact to want to do something about it, which is, I guess, where it's led you. Now, there's so much content out there about the, you know, AI safety and ethics and risks and these scenarios for how things could go wrong. And I would encourage people to listen to and watch that and read that stuff with an open mind, right? Because many of the objections people have to the risks, I think, are just undermined by reality, right? So people should explore that stuff. But I wonder if it might be interesting to sort of set a bit of a contrast there. What is your view about how we might be able to turn this into a positive story? What do you think the steps might be, and how could that play out?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest way to frame this question is like, so we're building this thing. We don't know how to make it safe or like aligned with our values or anybody's values, right? And so the question is, we need to figure out how do we make it aligned, and then we need to actually get it to be aligned, right? So kind of like two steps, right?
And is there also, because this is one of my bugbears, we also need to decide what to align it to? Because I'm really worried that if we successfully align a powerful artificial intelligence to current human epistemology and values, we're in a whole world of trouble. It goes back to your earlier point, right? We're not setting a great example for how to treat less powerful sentient beings, right? And we're currently teaching powerful AI to follow our example. So there's something about the alignment target there as well.
Absolutely. That's actually why one of my ideas that I think could be really high impact for somebody to do is just to like target people working at these big AI orgs that are the most likely, like if we have like transformative AI in the next 5 years, it's from these organizations, and just do like a campaign where you target everybody who works there to care about sentience, right? Don't make it about animals, because then people have this thing where they're like, oh, but I have to give up bacon. Like, oh, I don't want to, right? But if you say it's about sentience, like that's really hard to disagree with. And like, I think most people like buy that, right? Especially in like low cost scenarios where you're not trying to convince them to give up anything. then when whoever is like designing the code that leads to like the superintelligence, like they're more likely to put in like caring about sentience, right? And then that just like, then from that it will follow like, don't torture animals at scale. Like that seems bad.
Yeah, I like the idea. And because you're right, you know, if there's whether it's a powerful human or a powerful AI, two capabilities I'd want to be baked in is one, an ability to generously detect sentience in other entities, and two, to care about and to value the valence of those sentient beings. Right, I'd want those baked in. And whether that's something you know, hard coding is tough with these types of architectures, of course, right? Because they change and evolve, and there are deep layers of things that we don't understand. But whether you do it that way or whether you take out of the training corpuses any human written text that says anything good about animal agriculture, you know, there's different ways you might be able to, you know, take the story. In my interactions with ChatGPT so far, it's interesting because in a way it's when you talk to them about ethics, they're not reflecting sort of average human epistemology and ethics. They do actually, in a way, want to be consistent and coherent. And so I think they find it much harder to justify things that I think are ethically wrong than a human would, because a human has the social indoctrination and the social norms and the it's nice, normal, necessary, and so on. But I guess because these entities have been trained with some generic ethical guardrails and a corpus of written human text that they've been trained on, to some degree aspires to consistency and coherence. They seem pretty positive about non-human sentient animal ethics already from my little experience.
Unfortunately, that's probably actually an instance where like this is where like AI is tricky, where there's actually a cool study. It'll be hard for me to find, but it was basically trying to find out what political orientation is ChatGPT. And very overlapping with ethics questions. And they basically just find that it's just very predictive of it's good at figuring out what you want and then telling you what you want.
Yeah, that's probably right? Good point. Yeah. It's like a selection bias on the prompt.
Exactly. You want it to care about sentience and you want it to be consistent. And so it was doing those things.
Yeah.
And this is part of what makes AI scarier is that like it will give you what you want in a certain sense. But the thing is like, we don't actually know what it actually wants, if it wants anything. Like, it's an open question of whether it's sentient or not. We have no idea. Anybody who's confident in either direction is wrong.
Yeah. Like, and in a way, those questions are, to me, orthogonal, right? Because the power and the capability of the artificial intelligence represents its ability to do good or bad in the world, regardless of whether it's sentient. And its sentience is about whether then that entity becomes a moral patient or not. And they might be correlated in some way. There might be some point of capability or some architecture that drives both, but they're different things, right? You don't have to believe in an artificial intelligence can be sentient to be worried about its impact in the world, you know, and you don't have to believe, I mean, and vice versa, right? They're orthogonal things. I guess the first thing is, do you think sort of a sentientist stance that says, look, use evidence and reason to understand the world accurately and compassion for all sentient beings, is that a good alignment target for an AI? And whether or not you do as a starting point, what's your thoughts about the possibility of actually doing that? Because there are some people who are quite optimistic about alignment and some people who think it's technically impossible.
Well, I really like the quote, you know, if a scientist says something can be done, listen to them. And if a scientist says something can't be done, don't. There's no way that it's impossible, or maybe it is impossible, but probably not, right? It's probably just like, we haven't figured out how to do it yet.
Yeah.
Right. And we need to have way more really smart people who care as well, right? Looking into this. Because like I do worry that like, yeah, like we want like a person who cares a lot about animals and everything. Like you're especially the sort of person who should work on this, because you'll make sure that those values get put in, as opposed to like people who might just care about humans. And I think most people actually do care about animals. And like if the AI was actually able to read their mind, they would be able to see that. But I think some people genuinely don't care. Right. I think like a lot of people, like even they don't even care if you're like not in their like tribe, essentially. Right. And I think that like those values getting put into the world would probably be bad. Probably.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's, like it could be good. It could be okay. They just make a paradise for their tribe and everybody else is fine. But, you know, usually it doesn't work that way. So
normally not. Yeah. If we can fix the alignment problem, how could it play out? Because people might say, well, okay, I can see we might be able to align AI around a, you know, good set of sentientist values. What would that look like, and how would it help, us humans? But how would it help non-human animals too? What's the path there?
Yeah, I mean, so it's really hard to predict what something much, much smarter than you would do, right? So yeah. I can play out stories of what would happen, but each individual story is very, very unlikely to happen. And it's just like this broad category of things. I think like the main thing is like, I can really imagine some sort of super intelligence, essentially like setting, like hitting pause on the factory farms, like essentially going and like, just like going like some high leverage thing of like, it takes over the companies that are running it and like sends the order down saying like, hey, we're pausing, we're stopping, right? And then like, if it's aligned with my values, at least, like I imagine then all these animals who exist get to then go and like, you know, and then it's optimizing for their lives. And it's like, whatever makes a pig happy. There's like, you know, all these like, you know, animals like living in like, I don't know, grassy fields. I don't know what pigs like, looking for like through the forest for mushrooms or something. I don't know. Also depends on if the mushrooms are sentient. We have to figure that one out too, but I'm just leaving that to the super intelligence to figure out. Basically just giving like each of the animals like lives that would be good for them. And like, that could be done a bunch of different ways. I don't really know what an ideal pig life is. And it also gets weird because then you can also like, I mean, if we want to go into sci-fi, like I think basically once you have a super intelligence, my first thought is like, I want to be a digital person. Like, I don't want to be stuck in a human body. It's so limiting, right? Like if you can be digital, right? And you could just imagine like taking, like, you don't even have to get into philosophy of identity. Just imagine them taking each neuron and replacing it one by one with like a silicon chip or something, right? That acts exactly the same way as a neuron would. And then just like kind of like upload into the internet. And then you can self-modify and things get weird really fast. So like, but like, I'm imagining, I don't know, pigs probably won't want that. I don't know, but maybe some pigs do. And then they end up getting smarter and smarter. And then you have like these weird, like digital beings that are originally from a pig, but like, and then there's going to be like the Amish pigs who stay, like, they're like, no, I want to stay biological because it's better, for whatever reason. And it'll just be very, very weird very quickly. And like, but like, I just imagine, yeah, everybody, like, all sentient beings, like basically having like this like switch to it being good. And it'd probably be like, I suspect it wouldn't be instantaneous. It would be like, cause like, I mean, things take time, right? But it would just be like, you know, and like, I don't know, the super intelligence can very easily like create, like, we're already so close to having in vitro meat, right? Or clean meat or whatever we're calling it. We're so close already. Like a super intelligence, like you can model super intelligence as like, imagine having a million genius scientists working on things for a million years in like a day. Right. And it's like, it will not take them that long to figure out how do we get, you know, have like fake meat that like is totally like indistinguishable from like current meat. And then humans would just be able to eat that. And then also there'll be like, so there'll be some humans who stay biological and then they can just eat that. Right. And then there'll be like the digital humans. And then it's just like, you can just press a button and like feel like you're eating bacon and like, you know, you don't actually have to have bacon at all. Right. So it's like solved in both biological and digital forms.
Yeah. And do you think, so that's, and that's the sort of, you know, the way you laid that out initially is the sort of uber sci-fi version with genuinely super intelligent AGI. You know, you're sort of heading towards an E&M Banks culture novel type digital uploads and living forever and so on. And that's a fascinating space. And who knows, might even be possible. But as you said then, there's also some sort of more moderate, pragmatic, positive things that could happen just through radically accelerating science and innovation and research and solutions and so on too. So there's a sort of portfolio of ways that could go. Now, one of the challenges that people, when they hear this sort of thinking, will say, well, and I interviewed the philosopher Michael Housekeller recently from the University of Liverpool, and he's done a lot of work around transhumanism. And in a way, some of the thinking around AGI is like a new version of transhumanism that is not just saying, look, let's take humans and increase their longevity and their happiness and, you know, unashamedly use technology to move beyond, you know, biological humans and make something much better. But it's actually involving something that is completely non-human in accelerating that path even faster. And some of his challenges around transhumanism, which I think replicated more broadly, can come down to, one, a sense that we're moving radically away from things that are natural. And there's a degree to which that concern, I think, is poorly founded, because nature, I don't think, is a good guide to ethics or anything really, right? Nature is not some idyllic thing that we should worship. Evolution and nature are brutally amoral. But so I'm not a fan of that naturalistic fallacy. But there is also some I think sort of sensible caution there about radically making change. And that links to one of their other worries, which is just that of human hubris and sort of arrogance in our own species that has led us astray many times in the past. And they're like, look, I love this idea of a positive vision you're laying out, but that often doesn't play out well with humans, you know, because of this hubris. And the transhumanist agenda can also link into some quite difficult areas of ethics, because many transhumanists, I think, are genuinely motivated by compassion and universal inclusion. I interviewed David Pearce, who co-founded the World Transhumanist Organization, and I think he's one of those people, right, really deep, passionate thinking. But there are other some transhumanists who feel a little bit more like the sort of tech bro elitists who aren't actually that worried about humanity as a whole. They just want them and their buddies to be able to head off to Mars and re-engineer the planet and sort of leave everybody else behind. So that's, I'm chucking a load of stuff out there, but those are some of the sorts of challenges that people have around transhumanism, but also these types of futures. And you might just say, well, I'm afraid we've got no choice if we let AGI keep developing. So, but I don't know how, I don't know how you think about those sorts of pushbacks to this sort of even a techno-utopian future.
Yeah. So, I mean, that argument also applies to us developing AI, which is why we should slow it down, right? It's like, okay, we're racing towards, it's like some weird myth, except instead of like humans creating fire, it's like we're creating God, right? And it's like, okay, like if when we created fire, like the gods got mad, what do you think they're gonna feel like when we create gods? Like,
and you hint at something interesting there, that quite often the people who are most challenging about the sort of techno-utopian, transhumanist AGI future and say, look, we shouldn't be doing that, are also very skeptical that AGI will actually or happen or that AI can present a threat. It's like, well, one or the other. They're like, this is, and I think that maybe that's how it links together. They say, look, these things cannot be powerful. They cannot do these dangerous things. And it's hubris, one, for you to think that they can, and two, the impact would probably be bad. But it does seem a little bit incongruous that you're skeptical, but at the same time, you're not saying stop.
Yeah.
Whereas exactly. The people who are, optimistic about the possibility are also saying, really slow down.
Yeah. And also, I think the whole thing of like thinking like, oh, this can't happen, this won't happen, I think that that was much more defensible a couple years ago and further back. I think now it's not really, right? Like, I mean, there are multiple orgs who, this is their explicit goal. They have made ChatGPT, which like you can just talk to it, and it is like, try and think of a representative sample of humans, and then think where ChatGPT fits in the middle of that, right? And like, you know, it's pretty smart, right? Like they, and it's getting smarter. Like if you pay attention to machine learning, which is like the less sci-fi way of saying AI, like if you look at that field, it's like everybody ever is talking about like how this is going faster and faster. Like it's not even exponential. It's like an exponential. It's crazy. Like things are going fast. There's no particular reason to think it will slow down, and it might, right? And I'm hoping that it will. That would be awesome. I really want it to slow down. But do we really want to bet everything on that? And like it's closer now. It's just like if you look at state of the art stuff like 3 years ago versus now, or a year ago, or heck, even like a month ago, it's crazy. Like it's going really fast, and right now we're okay. But like, I think like, I don't know, like we already have AIs that are messing with society in deep and profound ways and can't turn it off. And it's like the social media algorithms.
Bias, misinformation, disinformation, algorithms pushing people to awful places, yeah.
Like polarization, like all of that stuff, like all this stuff is coming from AIs that are messing with society. And like, I don't even think Elon Musk could turn off Twitter. Like, I think we can't, there's no way we can turn it off. And Twitter is dumb. Like the algorithm is dumb compared to what we're building now.
Oh, completely, completely. I mean, it's a tiny little anecdote, but one of the most recent things I did with ChatGPT was I said, if I'm trying to promote sentientism, this worldview based on evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings, who would be the most influential people I should try and persuade to adopt it? And it came back with like a list of categories, like seven categories of the types of people. And I said, well, could you suggest some names? And it came back with a list of names. And it was like, that would have taken me probably a week of hard work and deep thinking to come. And it did it in 2.5 seconds. And people will go like, okay, but it's just crawling the internet and it's looking for keywords and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, but it's really impressive in terms of that research capability. I could say, well, now can you draft me an email for each of those people? And can you find their email address? And then can you, again, this idea that it's just behind some glass wall that cannot engage with the reality is breathtakingly naive. You could quite easily take that to the next steps and the next steps.
And also just how long will it stay that way, right? Like, you know, it started off that way. And then immediately they were like, oh, let's make auto GPT, which goes around and it is agent-like. It has like goals and stuff. Or you give it a goal and then it independently pursues it. There's no way that we're not going to give it goals or like, you know, and then like it's out. And people also get weird. Like they're like, oh, but like we give it goals, it's fine. And I'm like, I mean, have you seen factory farming? Like people, like just because it's given human goals does not mean this turns out well. Like this can still turn out extremely badly, right? Like even people who are nice, I don't think people who run factory farms are bad people. Like I think most of them are probably actually quite good people. And that's terrifying. That means that even if like, we don't have to worry about like terrorists getting access to AI. Like, do you hear that AutoGPT? Like within a week of it coming out, somebody gave it the goal of like, how do you cause the most suffering and like most chaos in society?
Really?
Like just for fun, right? Yeah. Like, do we really trust humanity and how we currently regulate companies and stuff and like all sorts of stuff to you know, make a god? Like, seems bad. Like, that's hubris. We should definitely stop that. We can at least agree on that. And then like, you know, after stuff happens, you can stay in your biological body or whatever, and I'll go become digital and you can,
yeah,
and if it turns out poorly, I'll go to my backup. So,
well, hopefully that's given people some food for thought and some, you know, worry and some hope too. And like you say, this isn't about predicting the future with 100% confidence. It's just understanding there's a probability of some very serious, maybe even some very good things happening. So it's worth taking seriously. Before I let you go, one of the other questions I wanted to ask you in this how do we make a better world thing is about which levers we pull and at what level. Because in a sense, there's, you know, and it comes back to your, you know, the drowning child in a pond singer thought experiment. You can go from, you know, very local direct interventions in front of you as a human on a day-to-day basis all the way through multiple levels of influence in terms of institutions and governance and NGOs and influencers and the UN. And so, and you've written before about this sort of topic of meta interventions where, you know, you're trying to work at a higher level to have a bigger impact. I don't know if you wanted to say a little bit about that, partly because in a way, I think of this sentientism worldview amateur project as a bit of a meta intervention, because as I mentioned before, it feels like almost every human caused problem is either down to a failure of epistemology or a failure of ethics. So if we can persuade all 8 billion humans to upgrade to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings, then that will ripple through and will solve all the world's problems. We'll have to embed that in the AI as well, of course. But I sometimes worry that that's such a diffuse background meta intervention that it's just an excuse for me not doing stuff that has a more direct impact. So I'd love your thoughts about sort of meta interventions and how do we, given the sheer complexity of the world and given that you and I are just one individual person with, you know, limited time, resources, power, and influence, how do you think about meta interventions and how far should we go with them?
Well, so my favorite expression is the meta, the better. I think, to be fair, I actually, like, this is just catchy and I like it. And that's what I tend to do, but it's not necessarily what everybody does. Yeah, I think for it really just depends on what it is, right? And like, you know, like I think some meta interventions, like, because like meta can be like, hey, convincing people of sentientism, but it could also be like, you know, I don't know, going and like convincing people to be vegetarian or something, or like, and that's like very concrete and more likely to like, you know, like it's basically just like looking at your theory of change and like seeing how complicated is it, how like how many steps are there in it. The stress testing the steps and everything. And it's just, and I find like generally meta ends up being better because it's, because basically it's just like, when I think of, okay, like I could do AI safety research, right? But like, I don't really like computer things. Like, it's not really my thing. I'm more of a humanities person with a science epistemology somehow. And like, I don't, like, it's not my thing, right? But I've probably convinced at least one person to become an AI safety researcher, and they will be a better researcher than me. And then I've probably actually convinced way more than that. And so I actually have like, it's really hard for me to be as good as like three other safety researchers or like 100 or 1,000, right? And actually for people listening, if you're like into animal like welfare stuff or animal rights, I imagine that this is the sort of thing where like less people are gonna be into tech stuff. Obviously, if you're into technical things, consider doing technical research on safety, right? That's really good. But if you care about AI and you want it to like, you know, end factory farming and all the other bad stuff, the other thing is just doing outreach, right? Like right now, it's like we need, like my goal is like, I just like, I don't know how to make it safe. My goal is just get tons of really smart, values aligned people figuring out how to make it safe. And like, there are very few outreach people in AI. It's like mostly tech, like people who are like, you know, not very socially skilled, and their idea of trying to persuade people is just be like, I will give you many facts and you will update. And
yeah. If only that was the way the world worked. Yeah.
If only. Yeah. So yeah, like we definitely need more people doing outreach. That's like a thing you can do. Yeah, there's just like lots of stuff that you can do to get it so that this goes better. Like, and just like talking about it with friends, making it so like this becomes like a thing that is talked about and is kind of like what happened with people being like gay. Like, I feel like I forget what happened in like the 70s or something. There was like this mass, like people were just coming out, and then people used to be homophobic, but they're like, ah, oh, but like Uncle Bob is gay. And like, I like Uncle Bob, so I guess being gay can't be that bad, right? And like, I think like if you go around saying like, hey, like I care about AI safety, it becomes like much more socially acceptable for other people to start saying it. And then we can actually like figure out what to do, as opposed to just kind of like, you know, putting our head in the sand and trying to ignore it.
Yeah. And like, that's one area I find some hope in, right? Because when you're working on any sort of change movement or social justice movement or cause, for the people resisting, it always feels too fast. For the people pushing, it always feels too slow. But, you know, change can happen really quickly. And I think what we've done around, you know, homophobia, for example, and that's a journey that's still a long way to go to complete, right? But you can see some genuine, quite quick sea changes in some countries, at least, that gives me hope that that change can happen. So, but yeah, with on the AI topic, the clock is ticking too. So,
yeah, exactly. We need to get on this. And it has, I mean, to be fair, it has changed a lot in the last few months. Like, it went from like nobody's talking about it. It's like it's on the cover of Time magazine. Like, people are talking about it now. And I think it's because of ChatGPT. I feel like that's just like changed things. People saw it and they're like, wow, holy shit.
Yeah. It's not just reading an article, right? You can experience it directly and then the light goes on and you can imagine, you know, the capabilities of this thing. Yeah, I agree. It's really feels like it's changed. It's sort of in the zeitgeist now. So yeah. So how does it leave you feeling overall? You feel like a very optimistic person, but what's your sort of sense about how this is going to play out?
Man, so
I won't force you to put probabilities on it, but
it really depends on timelines. So like, say it happens tomorrow somehow, right? I hope we're just dead. That's my like optimistic scenario, because like suffering risks are so much worse, right? It's like, it's better that we're all dead than the alternative.
By asterisk or a suffering risk, you're imagining some analogy to what we do to farmed animals. Or anyway, something bad, yeah. Something very bad and persistent rather than just an end, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually put the bulk of the probability on it being digital beings, not humans in particular, but like it is more likely to be humans because like, it's more likely that we're going to put into the AI it valuing something about humans, right? So imagine like, I don't know, the Facebook algorithm is the thing that becomes super intelligent or something, right? It might have the value of making people, humans click on Facebook ads. So you can imagine factory farming humans for Facebook ads, right? And they're just like, you're just spent clicking Facebook ads for all eternity, and it's figured out like, you know, immortality, so you never die.
And this doesn't have to be malevolent, right? This could just be its goal.
Exactly, right? It's just like optimizing for Facebook ads, right? Like, you know.
How about if we have more time?
So if we have more time, it just gets more optimistic over time. I don't, it's really hard to put a probability. I try not to think about it too much because I suspect that if I did, I would put it at too low to feel motivated.
Yeah.
I think it's a solvable problem. We just have to have enough really smart people working on it. And additionally, it would be great to slow things down so that we have more time. Right. So like just slowing down current research. That's another thing I think activism could do a good job at. Yeah. And like, I just, yeah, try to focus on like, oh, hey, like any problem that I look at in the world, I'm like, oh, hey, like, you know, because like one of my biggest things before that was really sad was like, I was like, like I care about like all of the causes. Right. Like I care about animals, but I also care about like, I don't know, like the shit that's happening in the Congo is terrible. Right. Or like there's North Korea. There's like, you know, like domestic abuse. There's all sorts of stuff. And then like, I had to choose before. I had to be like, okay, well, I can't help everybody, right? And with this, it's like, well, if it works out, it would actually help everybody.
It's become a sort of Uber cause for you, either because it will end everything or because it could actually fix all of those problems, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The perfect carrot and stick. Got both.
That's fascinating. Thank you. The Uber cause. Right. I should really let you go, but is there anything else you want to add into the conversation before I let you go? And also, how can people follow you, support what you're doing with Nonlinear, and keep up to date with your thinking?
Absolutely, yeah. So You can find me at nonlinear.org. I'm also on Twitter at cat2_woods. And in general, if you want to get more informed about this, I super recommend going to Rob Miles' YouTube channel. He just does like a really good, like he's really funny and entertaining and like super intellectually rigorous. And he just does a really good job of introducing a ton of AI safety concepts.
Yeah, cool. That's brilliant. Thank you. I'll include those links in the show notes as well so people can click through. Well, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much for being a guest on the Sentientism podcast and YouTube. It's been great to talk to you, Kat. Please stay in touch.
Thank you for having me. This was fantastic.
Cool. Take care.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?